to create global engagement and aware citizenry. And we achieve that through speakers programs, through international exchanges, and high school programs. For those of you who may not be familiar with the International Leadership Visitors Program, it's a U.S. State Department premier international exchange program, which each year brings to the U.S. 5,000 up-and-coming leaders from countries all around the globe. We work with the State Department. We are the exclusive organization that works with them, and we bring about 275 of those leaders to the state of New Hampshire each year and arrange for them to have the opportunity to work and meet with their corresponding, you know, we might have journalists come, and we arrange for them to have an opportunity to meet with New Hampshire journalists, or we might have people from the judiciary and arrange for them to meet with judges and folks from our judicial system. We provide these opportunities for also for these folks to interact with New Hampshire citizens, to just get to know New Hampshire folks a little, get to know Americans a little. And our objective is to build strong international relationships, which in turn help build a global community based on shared values. And I certainly can't imagine a time when it's more important to have a global community that has some shared values than it is today. You could probably say that anytime, but I think I feel real safe at saying it today. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit membership organization. Our work is made possible only through the support of folks like you. If you are not a member, I would certainly suggest that you might consider joining. It's a terrific investment. And or if you woke up this morning and said, as Joan did, gee, it's the holiday season, and I really want to support some wonderful organizations in our community. There just happens to be an envelope on your chair that will assist you in accomplishing that. We do aim to be helpful wherever we can. Well, I was just getting to that part, Joan. Please, Kathy, would you please, if you have already supported us this year, I would be remiss if I did not say a very sincere thank you. So without any further ado, I'd like to invite Ann Ackerman to the podium to tell us a bit about our sponsor this evening, the Fulbright Association. Ann?
Thank you, Norm. As Norm said, I'm with the Fulbright Association of New Hampshire. I was very lucky to have a Fulbright haze to Greece and Bulgaria, and we have a number of our Fulbrighters here who have gone to all kinds of different places. The Fulbright is the largest international exchange program. It's over 70 years old, and under the Fulbright umbrella, there are over 20 programs. It's not just for academics. It's for people in different types of professions, people who are specialists in a wide number of areas, including various types of agriculture, the arts. So if you want to know more about Fulbright, I have information on the table over there. We're very excited that we're, as I say, in our seventh decade of existence. The association is for people who are Fulbright alum and friends of Fulbright. So if you haven't had a Fulbright grant somehow, you're welcome to join us, and there's information about that. I think the important thing, tagging along to what Norm said, is in this global world that we're living in, organizations that reach out people to people are critical. And what are institutions like UNH Manchester does in educating about world affairs and international friendship is vital. So I invite you to learn more about it. And just as a last comment about one of our programs, we have what are called insight trips. And these are trips with Fulbright for both members and non-members to different countries around the world. And they provide a lot of interesting entree, not only to see sites, but to meet people in those countries. So learn more about that too. And thank you for coming tonight. I'd now like to introduce the Executive Director for World Affairs Council, Tim Horgan.
Okay. Thank you all for coming tonight. We're glad that you were able to make it out. I know that many of you originally signed up for our Playing for Peace event. Unfortunately, one of the members of the quartet has a potentially career-ending injury to her hand. So first of all, thoughts and prayers for a quick recovery for her. But that gives me the great opportunity to thank Steve Martineau of Friends Forever International for jumping in very last minute. This happened on Wednesday, and I called him right up, and he was super excited, super happy to help out. So really a big thank you for saving our event today and having the... Yeah. as a way of a bit of background on Steve, he has been the executive director of Friends Forever since November of 2005. Prior to that, he spent time working for Habitat for Humanity in South Carolina, the Children's Museum of Boston, and My Town, which is an innovative inner-city youth organization located in Boston. Over the past several years, he has overseen the growth of Friends Forever International to expand to multiple sites across the continental United States, and establishing a Friends Forever Europe in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and the formation of partnerships and programs throughout the Middle East. Also, not in his bio yet, needs to be updated, I think, a little. They just recently got a place down in Belize, and one in, you just closed on... Another in North, yeah. So, Friends Forever, as you'll find out tonight, does great work in helping young people from mainly conflict areas come to the U.S., learn about how to work together, how to become friends, and several of the new programs that they're running are also taking U.S. High school students abroad to do some of the similar work that they do here. So. Enough from me. I'll bring Steve up, and thank you so much.
Thank you guys all for having me here today. Can you all hear me, I'm sure? All right, thanks. Thank you, Tim. Hearing you guys talk, hearing Norm talk, and I'm sorry, Anne, right, from the Fulbright, one of the things that I'm excited about is how much I get to meet people here in New Hampshire that really want to be engaged global citizens. And oftentimes, I don't think that there's enough of us around or enough of us who connect. So coming to an event like this is pretty exciting. The mission of Friends Forever is to empower youth leaders to connect, strengthen, and serve communities around the globe by combining their passion to make the world a better place with the skills, experiences, and resources needed to do so. This is part of our larger vision, where we want to see a world where youth are recognized and supported as the catalyst for building a better world. I tried a couple new things tonight because I had a couple days over the weekend, which my wife was like, I thought this was our weekend. Why are you preparing a slideshow? And I said, you knew what you signed up for. So. I'm going to give you sort of a past, present, and future of Friends Forever, but I also want to give you a small taste of the interactive nature of our program that we do for our young leaders. from when they were recruited until 12 months later when they finished their first year of the program. So I'm gonna ask you to sort of go with the flow. It's like I tell the kids, you know, I have to explain to them what a hippie is. And so, you know, the couple that know what a hippie is, I say, just go with it. So one of the concepts that we introduce is mindfulness and meditation, which many of them have no experience with. So we're gonna do something like that right now. So if everyone can shut their eyes, sit in a comfortable position, back straight. Now take one deep breath. Now a second deep breath. Now imagine that you are 15 years old and the thoughts that must be going through your mind as you contemplate joining Friends Forever. You're going to a different country, the USA, which you see a lot about in the news and the media. What will it be like? Will they actually welcome you here? Is this the USA that you always heard about from your friends and family, or is it different? And you're going to be leaving your family for longer than ever before. You're going to be leaving your friends. And some of them are going to ask you, why are you going to America with those people? Now you are flying on a plane, probably for the first time going over the ocean. Now you are living with 9 strangers, and half of those strangers are the other. They're the people that media, everyone has told you, hate you, lifelong enemies. And you're sleeping in the same room as them. Now it's July and you're not hanging out every day with your friends, but instead you're getting up at 6 a.m. every day. There are only 2 bathrooms and 2 showers for 12 of you. Instead of going to the beach, you're volunteering, often for the first time, with people without homes, people experiencing food scarcity, or people with the most severe disabilities. Now, for the first time, you have to cook your own food. Sometimes you have to cook for 12 other people. Now think about how you have to compose and deliver a speech to a crowd of people in your second or third language. And you can't text any friends for support because you have to abandon your phone at home as a rule. A phone that you've had next to you since you were 10 years old or younger. And it feels like cutting off a limb. Next, you're traveling in a van and are exhausted, and you wake up with your head on the shoulder of a teammate who's Jewish, and your mind is blown. Now you're laughing every night at the end of the day with your impossible friends. Now you feel the anxiety of your speech day, but now your speech is over. Now you're writing each night in your journal. Now you talk to your parents on the phone at the end of the week, and you understand that time is different with Friends Forever International, because it seems like you just landed, but you have squeezed 3 months of activities into 6 days. Now you're getting ready to fly home, and now you're talking to your parents and brothers and sisters and friends, and they can't understand what you went through. And now you're challenging your families and friends when they say racist things. And now you hear Arabic on the street, and instead of feeling fear, you look over and see that it is your friend. And now you are hugging them hello. Okay, you can open your eyes. So we're gonna go now to the beginning. It's 1986. It's a time of great cinema and fashion. A director of a YMCA just outside of Belfast, Northern Ireland, sent dozens of letters to YMCA directors across the USA, asking them to bring over 10 Protestant Catholic young men to get them out of the troubles. Only one man replied, our founder, Bob Raisch. Nearly 60 years old, Bob was at an age when many people are considering what they'll do when they retire. But with the youthful energy that he had until he died in 2014, Bob devised a unique formula that became Friends Forever. He relied on local volunteers to provide the funds, but more importantly, the programming for the 2 weeks. When they went home, their parents and educators called Bob and said that the young men were transformed in ways they had never imagined, and when could they send the next group over? But what was really amazing was that the citizens that Bob enlisted here in New Hampshire, they started calling Bob up, saying, when can we donate again, and when is the next delegation coming? Because Bob had not only asked them to give their funds, he asked them to give themselves, to give their ideas. Bob knew that you don't need a degree in peace studies to be involved in a peace program. Peace is not a specialization. It's as natural as breathing, and we have to relearn this. Since 1986, we've grown from a 10 boys, handful of volunteers, to 200 participants annually, and now 1,700 alumni from a total of 150 global delegations. We've had 27 international partner organizations, past and present, from Israel, Northern Ireland, Cyprus, Uganda, the United States, and most recently from the Ukraine, a connection that came about from Tim and the World Affairs Council. We've had 2,500 donors since 2006, and that's important because we do not accept any direct government support. We also don't have big foundations that support us. It's all regular people, small gifts, small family foundations that make this work. We've had, just last year alone, 108 partnerships with community organizations, and 1,800 community members were engaged. Joan knows very well a lot of our supporters, a big one, Maxine. She's over at Webster at the Rye. But when I say community organizations, community members engaged, this means that we have our young people, they'll go to Riverwoods, they'll go to an assisted living facility 3 times over the course of 2 weeks. To volunteer, do workshops, get mentorship, so it's a deep and meaningful engagement. We also now, as Tim mentioned, we have a 3-acre peace campus in New Hampshire, right in Durham, where we're opening our doors to any individual and organization that shares our vision, who wants to lead their own trainings and workshops. So I leave that all out for you guys. If you know of anybody who's gonna be down the seacoast, we have space like this where people can speak. We have a farmhouse, which is a B&B, which is on the sort of 2 o'clock there. We're happy to host anybody that's visiting. Just let us know. So very quickly, what is Friends Forever International? Is it a youth leadership development program that's creating generations of change agents dedicated to peace and problem solving communities that need the most? Or is it an inspiration to everyone that encounters it, who are bombarded with apathy, fear, and the divisive discourse that overwhelms our senses if we allow it? It is both of these, but so much more. We believe that in order to build a better world, individuals must simultaneously connect with themselves, with each other, and with the earth. When a young person builds skills and self-confidence by overcoming fear and apathy with the help of others, they realize that they can take these skills to overcome challenges in their community and tackle the greatest conflict of all, that between the human species and our planet. And that begins right from the start when they complete our online enrollment form. Now, you guys should all have some materials in your folder right now. So in there, on the one of the sides, it should say the enrollment sheet. You guys see that? So I just want you to take a moment. And if you've got a pen or want to think about them, complete the following questions as I read them aloud. And the reason I do this for you is that every young person that comes in our program, after they've been selected, so we tell them that. We don't want propaganda. All the time we're telling them, don't tell us what you think you want us to hear. I tell them that my BS radar is huge. Okay, I know exactly. We want authenticity. Everything we do is about authenticity. So they're already selected. So we say, answer these as honestly and truthfully as you can. And it's just part of the sort of psychological profile that we're creating. And it's part of the process where they begin to understand this is a different program. So we ask them, how much time do you spend outside each day? I'd like you guys to just think about these yourself. How much time do you spend on screens each day? How confident are you in public speaking? Describe your family in 5 words as it is right now. I'd like you guys all to think about that very quickly. Be honest with yourself. Right now, what's going on with your family? 5 words that describe it. List 3 strengths you possess. Oftentimes, our young people don't have confidence. Nobody tells them about the strengths they possess. We also say, list 3 weaknesses. Then we ask them to recall a time when they helped somebody, but also to recall a time when somebody helped them. Now, you may be wondering how these all relate to a traditional conflict resolution program. And I can tell you that from my years of experience, we understand that a lot of the programs that are similar to ours, they're asking young people to solve these complex geopolitical conflicts. Bibi and Abbas, Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness. And then when they don't get anywhere in solving these situations at the age of 15 or 16, it feeds that perpetual myth that this is an intractable conflict and that it can never be solved. And this leads to apathy. And it also ensures that the conflict resolution industry stays relevant, right? But what we've found out and what we've understood over the years is that if you look at these things through the lens of conflict resolution, that's what you're always going to see. So for example, when we're at the farmhouse and Joan, who's Muslim, is in a fight with Katie, who's Jewish, and it's over the shower and they're fighting over something else and it's very heated. And if we're a conflict resolution organization, we're saying, look at that. We knew it. They weren't going to get along. There's, you know, how many generations of battling? And they've got all this sort of tension built up, and ooh, we knew it. People sort of get excited about that. But what we know from reading these enrollment forms is that Joan, when she wrote down 5 words to describe her family, wrote, grandmother, best friend, is dying. And what Katie wrote down is mom and dad getting divorced. They don't even realize that that's where their conflict is coming from with each other, because they haven't learned how to process that suffering. What they have learned for the past 15, 16 years through media, government, schools, family, it doesn't make a difference, is that suffering you feel, that's your fault. You're the other. That suffering is from the Jew, the Catholic, the immigrant, the 1%, the liberals, the woman. And so what we're trying to help them understand is that not only did that person not cause your suffering, but that we're all suffering. And that suffering that you're going through too, you're realizing at the same time that they're going through it. And you're also realizing that you're not going to fully be able to transform that suffering without their assistance. We're trying to get them to learn how to transform their suffering into strength and compassion. Now, the first phase of their program in their homeland is called our team building seminar. So our program is in 3 phases. It's a year-long, 3 phases. They have to meet a minimum of 3 times. They participate in an overnight residential like this, and they have a combined parents meeting. The seminar is an intense, very intense 36-hour experience. It's completely led and organized by our alumni. And they work with each youth to help them understand that all the hard work is essential to be a part of Friends Forever. Most of them, not all, stick out that seminar and stick out the program. And they're happy about it. 90% of our young people surveyed afterwards state that so far this has been the most amazing experience of their lives. Now, as I said, the seminar, 5 to 10% will choose not to continue afterwards. And that's okay. We work with them, we try to keep them engaged, but I also make it the most difficult 36 hours that they've had. And the reason why, and I tell them this, is although I don't have children, I'm an uncle. And I grew up with my niece and nephews from when they were babies all the way up. And there's one rule that Unky had, which is there's no whining within 10 feet of Unky. And I tell the young people that too. I said, look it, we're not gonna be hypocrites. The program you have in the US will be hard, but it won't be as hard as today and tomorrow. I guarantee you make it through today and tomorrow, you'll be all set in America. And they agree. We might not be the biggest program, but what I'm always striving to do is to be the most challenging program. So lots of our young people will go on other programs, and the question I ask is, was it harder than ours? And if they say no, then we're happy. What happens though when they see these alumni elite is that they realize that right from the start, we're unlike most other organizations, because we just don't say we believe that youth are the answer to the problems in society. We let our young people run the whole program. They see 18-year-old, 19-year-old young people. They don't do everything perfect. They run into audiovisual problems. They fumble, whatever. And that's perfect, because you don't want somebody so polished up there that as a young person, when you're beginning your adventure, you think, I could never be that person. The models you want to have, you want to see, they need to be bridges for you. The other thing that we do is I tell them, look at this program is not for you. This is not about you. And that is a big shock for them. Because when you're 15, you are biologically feeling like a victim. The whole world's against you, wherever you are. You can be 15 in the Hamptons in New York, you can be 15 in Uganda, you can be 15 in Israel. The world is against you. Your ego's under attack, you're misunderstood, you don't understand yourself. And especially when you're 15 and you live in one of these places we work in around the world, you also begin to feel attack on the community level. Everyone hates us. Everyone is against us. And what's weird, and we used to do it, is many programs, by this sort of twisted Pavlovian logic, reward that feeling of victimization, because you'll bring them to the US. You're a victim of conflict. Come to the US. It's sort of like a weird way to look at it. And what I do is I sit them down and I say to them, look at, there's 100 of you selected from around the world. I value my time and the impact I can make on this world more than 100 people. I'm like, you guys are great, but it's not 100 people. I wouldn't spend my whole life doing this. What I say to them is that your leaders that recruited you to be on this program, the people that selected you to be on this program, they expect you to impact 100 people this year. I say, I value my impact at 10,000 people a year. And that's where you fit in. And what happens is instantly you see this light bulb go off in these young people, because some of them come from pretty challenging backgrounds. And to be told that they are there not because they are weak and because they need help, but because we need their help, is exactly what they need to hear. And I don't know if you guys recall that study that was done years ago where the researchers told the fourth grade class teachers, they took a certain amount of kids and they said, randomly, they said, they're scoring off the charts, they're all gifted students, and they gave that to the teachers. The teachers took that in and they treated those kids differently. And then they did the longitudinal studies and those kids ended up outperforming the rest of the kids by huge levels. And those kids began to believe that they were gifted. And so that's sort of the mindset that we're trying to do, the growth mindset we're trying to have. And what's also cool is that light bulb is both the combination of both anxiety and confidence that comes when somebody is holding you responsible for something. It's very rewarding to be held responsible for something. Following the seminar, we get together with all the parents for each group. Now, each group is made of 10. Now, a few years ago, our partners pushed back on us everywhere, Belfast, Israel. Parents won't like it. They won't come together. They have all their own baggage. They're too busy, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, I listened to that, and then finally I was like, you know what? I was like, forget this. I'm like, if they want to come on the program, if they want their kid to come on the program, they meet up. We need that sort of commitment because they have all these meetings that they have to attend when they get back home. And we need those parents on board to bring them, transportation-wise or whatnot, to the meeting. And lo and behold, the parents come. And as you can see, they absolutely love it. These parents have been waiting for this program, for themselves. And they'll do, you know, whether or not these parents agree with peace, whether or not they think that it's just a whole bunch of baloney and they just want their young kid to get a CV trip or a trip to the US, they'll do whatever it takes for their kids. 99% of parents will do that. They hold that in common. So we're manipulating them, and I have no problem. That's fine. It adds to our value proposition. It adds to our impact. It creates a stronger support system for the young people when they get back home. And they begin to realize that they have a family with them as they undergo this transformation. The other thing that we do, because people ask us, one thing that we do that most other groups can't, is we track all their attendance when these kids go home. They have to attend or else they don't graduate. So why would they stay? Now, they can stay to be involved in alumni, but one of the reasons that they stay is I'll ask them all, raise your hand. Who here is a brother and sister? So you guys, who here is a brother and sister? Anyone? Okay. We're going to track your brothers and your attendance. If you don't go to 75% of your meetings afterwards, and your brother or sister wants to come on this program, that's what we look at. So what we're going to do is if your brother and sister is tied with somebody else, and we turn away hundreds of kids a year, they're tied with somebody else, we're going to look at your attendance record. If you went the majority of the meetings and were good, your brother or sister comes. If you didn't, your brother and sister doesn't come. And I guarantee you, wherever I am around the world, every father normally, or mother, looks at their son and daughter and says, you're going. So whether or not they get along with their brother or sister, you have that family tribe that is essential to the work. Next, we enter the skill building phase. And for most of you here and for the people abroad, that's what they know most about us. That's how we started 30-something years ago. That's the 2-week trip here to the US. And they're going to have to practice now healthy living. No fast food, maybe one trip to Wendy's, maybe. No energy drinks, no soda. I mean, this is big changes for them. Again, lots of pushback from our partners, but we tried to help them understand, which they now do, the behaviors of their kids would go up and down because they were chugging a 2-liter of soda. So they're blaming these things on conflict or troubled backgrounds while they've got a 15-year-old slamming a Red Bull. Let's remove a lot of the variables before we're going to go right into these larger, deeper issues. We now have them learning how to cook vegetables. They learn how to meditate. They're going to be volunteering an average of 35 hours. They're all giving public presentations in front of groups like this. 100% technology free. Cell phones don't even come on the plane with them. They get 3 5-minute phone calls home, once when they land, once halfway through, and once a few days before they head out. They're all going to live in one home together. Now, the 2 leaders that they come with, the teachers, they don't do any of the chores. We teach them how to project manage the house, just like a small business. They have to get together, they have to work out, they have to negotiate project facilitation skills, they have to run their chore chart, They have leaders of the day who are responsible each day for waking up everybody to do all the nagging. And let me tell you, after you've been leader of the day one day, you're a hell of a lot better leader or follower the rest of the days because you know what went into it. All the groups do 40 activities in basically 12 days. It is intense. And all those activities are based off our recipe. Now, our recipe is an acronym, and it's resilience. So innovation and resilience is critical to solving problems. And we believe that trying new things, getting out of our comfort zone, and learning from our mistakes or failures is probably the most essential part of learning. And if a young person in our program isn't failing at least once a day, then that's what I'm talking to our staff about. We actually find that we have problems primarily with lots of the young women who come on the program. They are terrified of failing. They are used to being perfect in everything that they do. And I believe that that's part of the reason that they not only have anxiety and stress, but that's sometimes why they're not taking on leadership positions when they get out into university and whatnot, because they have conditioned themselves to feel comfortable on this track of just receiving positive feedback towards jobs well done. We give people positive feedback when they push themselves and when they fail. And that changes their mindset, because what they're looking for is the positive feedback. It's up to us to determine what we're going to give it to them about. The next thing that we do is empathy. Empathy is where we have to go into places that are unfamiliar with us or challenge us. We believe that performing meaningful acts of community service is the most powerful team builder. We have this idea, and you wouldn't know it by looking at me, but it's around weightlifting. You wouldn't know it by looking at Tim either, so I can't use it, no offense to him. But we believe in about building an empathy muscle by serving the most ignored members of society. And it's critical to one's development. Because a lot of these programs, if you say, you guys don't get along, go ahead and get along. You know, Jewish and Muslim people get along. You know, Hindu and Muslim, Protestant and Catholic, we're like, yeah, I know, that's what I'm supposed to do here, blah, blah, blah. You know, they're jaded, right? Everybody's jaded on that sort of stuff. We don't even talk about that. We really don't talk about coexistence or conflict resolution in this whole program. What we do is we have them volunteering at least 7 or 8 times during these 2 weeks. They're volunteering all sorts of community service, people with disabilities, the elderly, people experiencing food scarcity. What happens is every time they're doing that, they're building this empathy muscle, okay? And it's just like if I'm lifting weights, if all of a sudden you threw a chair at me and I've been lifting weights for a while, I'll be able to catch that chair and put it down. I can't go back to my former weak state and let it hit me. Same thing with an empathy muscle. We build up that empathy so that all of a sudden, when they have that interaction, which will happen with somebody about a situation back home, that empathy muscle kicks in. And then they can truly put themselves in the other person's shoes and have that conversation. The other thing that we work on is communication. And the way that we talk about this is everyone has a story, and everyone needs to first understand their own story. And then be able to listen and understand the stories of others before we can create new stories together. We have the young people at the seminar, they do their life map. Because I got so sick of hearing kids say when they were going to give their speech, and I'd say, talk about yourself, and they'd say, there's nothing interesting about me. There's nothing, right? And so instead of me saying, yeah, sure, there's something interesting about you, we're going to go that way, what we have them do is we have them create a life map. Now, we don't have time to do it today, but what you would do is it would be modeled by some of our alumni, and they start however they want. They're on the ground. So they're like this, writing their life map. And the only rule is everybody's in silence standing around them. As I explained to them, you might be laughing with your buddy about something else, but if I'm writing about my mom or dad getting divorced and you laugh, I'll think you're laughing at me. And they all take it seriously. And the stories that come out of those life maps are mind-blowing. And that's right from the start. And that begins them to understand that they have this story. They have these, not only these, the suffering that's within them, but they also begin to understand why they act the way they do, why their family is the way they are. And we also are teaching them that the ability to share your story orally and in an authentic way, or through the arts, or in written form, this is going to be essential to create systemic change. We teach them to speak with confidence and to listen with an open heart. Now, this is Carmel speaking there. She's a Jewish participant this summer. She came this summer with a crippling fear of public speaking. Now, you probably all know that 70% of the world fears public speaking, okay? It's the primary reason, not cell phones, whatnot, that people do not come on our program, because they're gonna have to give 1 3-to-5-minute speech. They will not come over to the US, they will not come for 2 weeks, they will not participate afterwards because of that fear. And it's not an option to them. And I would have been that same way when I was their age and older. And when I say Carmel had a crippling fear, I'm saying that when we did the rehearsal with her and we practiced with her team, she stopped halfway through and she could not speak for 15 minutes. I mean, full tears. And, you know, we had some adults in the room. I said, every time her team supported her. The next day, she went to Riverwoods Assisted Living Facility in Exeter. She gave her speech and she nailed it. But what was very cool is that she almost turned around at the airport. Her father dropped her off at the airport in Tel Aviv, and she said, "Bring me home." And he said, "Stay, go, trust me." Instead of Carmel speaking about playing soccer or et cetera, which she could have done, that's what she spoke about. She spoke about the fact that her father had always been there for her, and she talked about how, because of weight issues and whatnot, she had been bullied out of 3 schools from the age of 12 through the age of 15. And she's talking about this stuff, and her Palestinian partner, she made her speech be the same thing, talked about how her mother supported her. And so it was talking about the superheroes in their life, which were their parents. And she said, "Oh, you know, I don't know if I did that good." And I said, "Are you kidding me?" I'm like, "You have, by this act, you've processed personal trauma at the age of 15 that people my age, people in their 40s and 50s, that's when they're just getting around to it at therapy." I'm like, "You have taken the biggest fear you have in your life and you've made yourself the most vulnerable you'll probably ever be in your life and nailed them in one shot." That was day 3. You couldn't take the microphone out of her hands after that. The next thing we do is impact, but impact with integrity. So honesty, transparency, living by the highest values, they're essential for our programming, day-to-day operations. And young people, everybody, but young people, they can sniff out hypocrisy a mile away. So we always have to live by our values, because we will be called out on it instantaneously. In 2018 alone, our participants provided a combined 2,185 combined volunteer service hours all around the globe. Now, the other thing that we do is impact is the people that we choose to work with. Now, we're very specific about who we choose to work with. Not anybody can just sign up in the program. If you're coming over from Belfast to work with us, we look at the demographics of your community. We look at the history of your community. We look at the sphere of influence that your specific school or organization is going to have, because we know that we don't have the funds to reach 2,000, 5,000 young people a year. So we really have to be targeted about who we partner with and work to give them this program. And by bringing in young people, we're creating these portals. And we're giving them the Friends Forever School of Thought in these targeted communities and regions where we can have these influence. Now, playfulness. For us, play is a core part of being creative. of exploration and also negotiation. We don't understand it now, but now people just don't go out and play and have to negotiate when Joan cheats, you know, in touch football or hide and seek. We used to have to work that stuff out. Now there's rules for everything. They can look on their phone on the app. How do you play hide and seek? How do you, there's a discussion. How do we do this? So we bring that back into them because play is so essential for that. It's also the way that brings glue. You know, if I'm having fun with somebody for a long time and then we get in a fight or then we hit a lull, that memory of that fun is going to bring us back together to keep on track. And we want everybody to remember what it's like to be a kid again. When you're, and not just to have fun, when you're a kid, you're nimble. You go with the flow. You don't worry about it. So many of these young people, they come and their lives are all scheduled out for everything. We don't tell them what they're doing until the night before. They have no idea what they're doing until the night before. The last thing that we do and part of recipe is effort. And this is the foundation for all we do. We believe that successfully achieving one's mission, realizing your vision on the individual, community, and organizational level, and working towards its maximum impact requires 110% effort. I want them to take away, and many of them, they don't have jobs, and you know they're working at school, but I want them to take away, outside of an academic environment, that feeling of what it's like, that visceral charge you get when you work really hard for something, and it happens. That first paycheck you get, that first time that you know you have a well-deserved congratulations, that's what we're trying to do. Now, they process all these things through the memory books. Now, I think some of you guys saw some of those memory books. So that's the key for our curricula. So I'm gonna go quicker because I've been taking a while, but they're constantly evolving. We've had them for a couple years. This is the sixth iteration we've had in 3 years. We're always getting feedback from them, and we're getting feedback from you. But these are treasured by the youth. We actually call them their memory book because we tell them, you're not going to remember what you did 5 days ago, never mind 5 years from now. Now, this one I showed up there because in 2015 or 16, there were fires in Haifa, Israel, Carmel, Haifa region. A girl, Yuval Kutner, she sent us this photo. Her house caught on fire. Her house was destroyed. The one thing she saved and got was her memory book. Now, because our roots are in citizen diplomacy and community engagement, our impact on New Hampshire citizens is profound. And it's like the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. If Tim had called me and you guys were Raytheon, I'm probably not coming in a couple of days to come speak here. Okay, but I knew that our mission and vision are so in a line that that's why I wanted to come here, because I knew that you would understand that we're an opportunity for everyday citizens to directly participate in the international peace process. Too often, we relegate our responsibilities as global citizens to those in power, abandoning our ability to acquire knowledge and effective informed change in the name of convenience. Receiving our information from websites and media that will give us the answers we want to hear, not that we need to hear. However, there are those in this world and this room who realize that challenging the beliefs we have been raised with, challenging our parents' and our grandparents' ways of thinking, challenging our governments, and most importantly, supporting and encouraging our youth to do so is an essential undertaking. If we are to make the world a better place, we also have to impact Americans. Now, I also had a speech I was going to show you, but I'm not going to bother with that because it's not working. But it's on our website. We have a YouTube page. We have all the speeches that the young people give that are uploaded and closed captioned. I'd recommend you go there. But, you know, tonight, there's 40 of you guys here, roughly. And there's 40 different points of view. But the one thing I think that we all share is a hunger to be part of a family. Humans have a primal urge to be part of a community, and this can come in many forms: tribal, religious, socioeconomic, and ethnic groups. And like the World Affairs Council, we're trying to connect people. You know, many individuals that move here to New Hampshire from other regions to retire, or maybe they're from here and they just have a natural global curiosity, they're thirsting to have the international engagement that they had from where they used to live or work. I hear all the time that people who lived in Boston, New York, Chicago, any other places around the coast, they, you know, this is not a very diverse state other than some pockets. There's not a lot happening. That's why you guys are here. And sometimes it's hard for me to explain this bug to people who don't have it. And it's not that people want diversity, global diversity, for some sort of altruistic reason. We want it because we need it. We have that urge to just be around people with different cultural points of view. And that's why I'm involved in a lot of parts. It's selfish, it's enjoyable. And I feel most human. And this common sense of humanity informs all of our work now. This year, our programs, we're designing more innovative community service opportunities, we're cultivating capacities of the participants, we're developing a full year course that integrates the experience that the participants have here in the US with their work back home. And all these first two phases get to what's our final phase, our most important phase. And that's our community building phase where they do their social action project. Since last year, we've worked with 19 global teams and 208 total participants from 5 countries. Now, when I said earlier we track all their work with software, guess how many total reports we've received of their work when they're back home in Haifa, Belfast, or here in Rochester, or Nicosia, Cyprus? 164, and counting. That's 164 meetings between Protestants and Catholics under the shadow of this wall. It's 164 meetings between Jews and Palestinians in Israel, in a land where they're living in daily fear. It's 164 meetings in towns here in New Hampshire, which are being ravaged by opioids and poverty. And why are they doing it, as I asked before? Why do they agree to participate in a program that demands so much of both the students and the teachers when other programs are simply a summer holiday? It's because we challenge them. They realize now that they've learned how to identify challenges in their communities. They develop the skills to address these challenges. They practiced how to attract people and resources to assist them. And they've gained the self-confidence as individuals and the ability as a team to put their plan into action and make a difference. Here's one. This was a group that was here last year. The Jewish kids are from a kibbutz in the south of Israel, and the Arab kids were in the north. Their project is that they learned how to create soap from olives picked in the northern Galilee by a Bedouin. So they learned how to create the soap, and that's them learning how to do it. Then they cured it. That's amazing, right? We were like, that's great. What was more amazing is that the Arab youth brought the soap when it was cured down south. They then went to visit an assisted living facility that primarily was for Holocaust survivors. They, as a group, delivered this soap to them as Jews and Palestinian Israelis. And you can see what it meant. The staff there was in tears the entire time because of the impact that it had on the residents there. So they're not changing the world, okay? But they're changing the world for those people. Now, another one very quickly is in Belfast. There's only one park left in all of Europe which has a wall and a gate going down the middle of it that's locked up every day at 3 p.m. We work with partners that are on either side of that. Our young people came up with an idea. It's a very low socioeconomic group. They came up with the idea. This is what we're gonna do. They got city council to keep it open. They applied to us. We offer small $500 grants for all the kids if they apply, and I turn down the grants until they get them right. You know, they need to learn. They got the city council to keep it open. They used the money to get a Santa Claus suit. They put the Santa Claus right where the gate opening is. Then they're genius because they lived in that community and they knew. They went out and they bought small gifts for Santa to give away. And they told everybody on the Protestant side and the Catholic side, you're going to start here on the Protestant side. we're going to escort you down as 15-year-olds dressed like elves to the Santa. Your child is going to get a free gift. Then you must go up to the Catholic side for a big dinner. Now, why did they know it was going to work? Because primarily everyone there was on welfare, on the dole. And they knew that those parents would do whatever they had to do to get that gift. I couldn't have come up with that. I don't know what the needs are in that community. That was 3 years ago. Year one, they had 30 young people. Last year, they had 240. And this is the power of the team. And when I say team, what I mean are 10 brave and amazing young individuals that have decided to commit themselves to a program that can lead them to losing friends that remain prejudiced, to being ostracized by their family, or in some cases to actual violence when they no longer play by the sectarian rules that they were raised to. This is a Protestant participant, Jamie Bickerstaff. He was traveling to the Catholic side of the wall to meet his friends. This is a success story. He was set upon by a gang of Catholic men. He was beaten severely. He had a black pellet gun put to his head, and he thought it was a real gun, and he was shot 6 times in the head with it. He thought he was going to die. When he was released from the hospital in the coming days, when he was released from the hospital in the coming days, the newspaper, they were all after him. They wanted that juicy tidbit, and he didn't give it to them. He just said, listen, I do want justice, but I don't want revenge. I want justice because I don't want them to do it again to somebody else. The cool part about this story, other than him saying that, is a week later, a large march led by a very, very activist, Catholic activist, 19-year-old, was led. This guy is in Sinn Féin. He's a big deal. He took Jamie. He said, you're coming with me. We'll see if anybody says anything to you. They led a large march throughout all the Catholic areas where he was beaten. And he said, this is going to be ending. What's amazing to me is that young man was Owen McShane. He went through our program 5 years earlier. He didn't know Jamie went through Friends Forever. Jamie didn't know he went through Friends Forever. I just happened to see it on Facebook. So all this is always happening. In the summer of 2014, our July group from Israel arrived just as the conflict in Gaza was beginning to escalate. We take away all their cell phones. They really had no idea. When they arrived, it was still a skirmish, but then at the end of the time, it had gone from only a couple dozen people who had died to 700. On the day before their departure, I don't know if you guys remember, I needed to sit them down because I didn't know if they were going to be able to fly. The flights were being shut down outside of Tel Aviv because bombs were going over Tel Aviv. And I had to prepare them for what they were heading back to. And originally they were nervous because if I, the executive director, asked to see them all, they were in trouble for not cleaning up the house or something. But when I tried to explain to them what had started in their absence, they went sort of from shock to sadness. And I was expecting between them, I was worried, is this going to tear them apart? Because they were totally loved each other. And I thought I'd see rage and shouts of incrimination, you know, and the group to be torn apart with this knowledge, like everybody was back home. But what I encountered was silence for 1 minute. Then 3 minutes. And then there was a jokester of the group, and he was a Jewish boy named Tal. And he was entering the military in a year and a half. And he raised his hand and he asked if he could ask a question. And I nodded and he asked, how many civilians in Gaza are dead? And I told him it was around 700. And he said, that's all I need to know. And that's all it took. And it doesn't make a difference who asked the question. It could have been on either side. It was the fact that the person asking the question was not asking from his own point of view, he was asking from the other point of view. Everybody was waiting for the first thing to be said to launch their own verbal attack. And he completely disarmed that. And after a few more moments of silence, each student left literally holding hands in twos and threes, mixed groups. They walked around the neighborhood of Newcastle, and they came back together an hour later with tears and brave smiles to tell me they would make a difference back home. And they did. On the night after they returned, with sirens blaring and bombs exploding, the group and all 20 of their parents got together for a meal. This was not happening. Normally it doesn't happen anytime in Israel. This definitely wasn't happening in August 2014 of Israel. And it sustains. A year later, they're still getting together, right, in 2015. Now some are off at Technion, some are in the military, but they still get together. Then there's Maxwell. When he was 18 years of age, he was an Acholi from northern Uganda. When he was 9 years old, he was pushed out the back door and told to run, and he spent a week in the bush. When he returned, he saw that his sisters, mother and father, were burned to death by the Lord's Resistance Army. He found his grandparents in Kampala. He was raised by them. And grandparents don't always, you know, have that same familiar relationship, but they took him in. And he taught him, the grandfather taught him the trade of how to make musical instruments. And this is his boap. And Maxwell, when he was with us, wouldn't let go of that. This not only was something he learned to play and he built it, this was his therapy, right? This was what he could hold on to. Led him to be part of the group that we partnered with in our first Uganda program. When he arrived, he was shy. He told me, "I don't think I belong here." He could build 8 different instruments and he spoke 5 languages. I'm like, and he survived what he did. I'm like, you'll be fine, Maxwell, don't worry. In 3 weeks, he transformed into leader of this group. He was first to talk about the impact of the program. Here he is discussing his future with one of our alumni. This alumni took off. The only 2 weeks he got out of the Israeli military, he took off so that he could volunteer with this group. Maxwell headed back with his team. They took the Friends Forever pedagogy, they combined it with music and drama skills, and they created a program for hundreds of children in the Kasokoso slum. It's the worst in Kampala. They worked with Peace Corps to do HIV screening, and they did screenings for 250 people and programs for 450 youth. I was just on Facebook with Maxwell a couple days ago. This is the orphanage that he founded and is the executive director of now. So this is just the beginning. So in our strategic plan, we're going to work to train adult educators like the group we had from the Ukraine in our methodology so that we don't always have to bring young people here. We can train people and they can bring that back home. We're going to be developing original content, movies and podcasts and curriculum to be open resource to communities all around the world. We're going to begin to offer programs to urban and rural youth from communities across the U.S. We're planning the purchase and operation of a campus in Belize around environmental sustainability and also to serve those youth, because I think we can all agree it's not going to be anytime soon that we're going to be bringing up people from the Americas to do our program here. So instead of us throwing up our hands and saying that's the end of it, we went out, we found somebody who had a place in Belize. They believed in it. They gave it to us, 24 beds. That's what we're going to do. We're not going to let stuff stop us. We also have a program, a campus in Northern Ireland that we're planning on getting. This is going to be to serve all the groups from New Hampshire that now we're bringing over to Northern Ireland. We do this because we believe that youth are not a problem, but an underutilized asset when it comes to tackling our communities and world. Community service is the core component, because when you're volunteering hand in hand in soup kitchens, an elderly home, or with an American 15-year-old with cerebral palsy, it's like a psychological slap upside your head. It says, snap out of your victim mentality. Let your precious ego go. You feel and understand that nothing is as empowering as serving others. Serving others helps us all understand that we all suffer and we all have the ability to ease other sufferings, that we're all in this together, that we're all a global family, that we're all friends forever. I'm going to leave you with the knowledge that we evaluate everything we do. We evaluate all our programs, and our young people give us this feedback. We send out surveys at the end of the year to every student to give us their feedback. And this is what we got from Robin. And I think her words can more eloquently express pretty much what I've said here today. And I've included it in your folder as well. When we create peace with ourselves, it becomes so much easier to create peace with others. Those who are ready, those who aren't, those who do not know, we all have to complete the final step for ourselves. Friends Forever cannot tell you who you are or what you want, but they can give you the tools to unlock this revelation for yourself. You learn things and you bring them home, and in every conversation with your family, your friends, colleagues, or even people in the street, with your new, broad, and diverse outlook on this earth and the beings in it, you can spread the message of peace. In many cases, large change is a cause and effect chain of small changes. In every story you tell, idea you present, and feeling you share, you are creating change. Often our society is so cold towards change. Be the one who warms the hearts of those in your community so they too view their fellow humans in compassion's forgiving light. Even if I could wear a sign that says, "You are the change. No, really, come ask me about it," so that everyone I pass could see it, I don't think I would be able to convey how much power I believe this philosophy holds. Thank you very much. Sure. So what we do at the seminar is over in Northern Ireland and Israel, when people have these two-day experiences for youth groups, what they'll do is they do lots of like fun activities. So the settings where we have it normally, there's horseback riding, there's water sports, there's games, etc., right? And there's lots of like very fun team builders and all that sort of stuff. We get that all out of the way in about the first 15 minutes. Then there's a bucket. Throw your cell phone in the bucket. Then what they have to do is we start putting them through their public speaking workshop, where they're actually standing up and practicing public speaking. We start having them meditate. And when you're a 15-year-old and you are amped up on whatever sugar you gorged on before you got to this awful thing where they were only going to give you vegetables, to have you sit down in silence for 15 minutes is difficult. And we run them through this whole thing. They start at 8 a.m., so that means that they normally have to drive about an hour and a half. So they have to get up at 5:36. I could start it at 10 a.m. I could start it at 12. I do it so that they have to get up early. Because what I want them to do is, if you're too tired or lazy to get up for this, you're not going to be ready to get up at 6 a.m. here in the States. We don't want to deal with it. So we begin at 6 a.m. They go all the way through. It's like a mini program. They go all the way through to about 10 or 11 o'clock at night. They end every night like we do here in the program with a debrief. We have a rule in my family, my wife and I, we don't go to bed mad. I don't care how long it takes, because if you go to sleep mad or unresolved, you're gonna wake up more tired than you would if you stay up till 4 a.m. getting everything handled. They have to go through that whole process. They wake up the next morning, 7 a.m., they're cooking the meals, helping you participate in the meals, and they go through. So it's a very rigorous program where they're not used, they have to do lots of writing and stuff. A lot of the kids we work with, specifically from Belfast, they are on the academic low track. So when we're having them get up and write a poem and recite a poem, when we say there's no smoking, we normally have 40% of our kids from Belfast smoke. They have to not smoke during this, and they have to go on a patch before they can come on this program, because obviously we don't allow any smoking or whatnot. And they don't believe it, because they're like, no, I'm on the program. They're like, you're gone. Like, you can't smoke. So it's those sort of things that we do. Is that answer, or do you want more in depth? Or I'm happy to provide any of that stuff too, if you want. Does anybody have any other questions? Or go ahead.
I'm sorry, I missed the first couple of minutes. Traffic's bad today. Can you explain how students get into this program, how they're attracted
Sure.
Are they self-selected? Obviously,
right.
Through some of the requirements that will self-select. But how did they hear about it? And what do you do to make sure that you get the diverse groups that I think you're after?
That's a great question. So what I do is, because we have a very small staff, and I said earlier I've got a good BS radar, but I don't have a great BS radar, right? So I'm not going to go over to Israel and meet young people, because they could sell me a line of goods and their teachers, their peers are going to know that's not who this person really is. So what we do is we have a very rigorous selection process for schools and organizations. It's a 3-year waiting list as a school and organization to come on our program. Because once you're on our program, we try as hard as we can not to lose you. Our goal is to symbiotically evolve with the groups. I'll tell you guys this, because you're not gonna tell them. Our partners don't realize it, but they are part of a larger sort of laboratory where they are participating in changing the field of youth work. Because youth work needs more professionalism, more expertise. And so what we do is we have the highest demands placed on our partners, because say I go, you're the principal of the school, you're on this program, which is highly thought of, kids go back home, it's not only the parents who will miss out for their brothers and sisters who won't be able to come on the program. If less than 7 kids end the program, the 8 meetings, your school is on probation. The next year, if there's any other issues that we've had, you're at the back of the line, you're out, because we've created this demand for our market. And we did that very consciously, is because we also let everybody know, you know that there's a demand. You know that there's 6 other schools in Israel that are waiting to participate. There's 8 other organizations in Northern Ireland that want to participate. So they are responsible for recruiting and selecting their own young people. We, our alumni, play very integral roles in recruiting, going out, speaking to the classes, going personally to different clubs and organizations and schools, et cetera, to attract young people. And they also participate in the interview process, but it's up to the schools to have the final say, because that's who I'm holding accountable at the end of the day.
All right, Steve, I have one question.
Sure.
So I know you have a tattoo, but I think it perfectly embodies your commitment.
Sure. So I happen to be a vegan. And I know, shocking. And I drive a Prius. I know. You guys are like blowing your minds. What's it? Yeah. So there you go. Right. You're not vegans. All right. Give it time. And so what happened is, because I travel quite a lot over to Israel and Palestine, and if you've ever been over there, especially, everybody's great hosts, but especially on the Arabic side, you know, Arabic hospitality is, it makes Southern hospitality look like New Englanders, right? I mean, it's it's out of this world. And it was so difficult for me to have to always explain to everybody that I'm vegan. They don't know, they're like, what is vegan? The first year I explained vegan, all I got was fish. I'm like, no, you know, that's not it. So what I did is that I've actually got a tattoo that there's a new font that was developed by a design person, which is both Hebrew and Arabic. And so if you read Hebrew and you look at this, it says vegan, tivoneh in Hebrew, and in Arabic it says hodri, which is vegan. And so I got this tattooed so that now if there's a little bit of confusion, it's very functional, right? I can, you know, that's the only way my mom was gonna not go crazy. It's functional, but also for the young people we work with, they truly see that we don't fall one side or the other. We are completely, they understand, you know, I'm from upstate New York. I've got French Canadian, you know, whatever in me, you know, I'm of no religion. That there's nobody with a secret angle on this thing. It's completely about them, youth leadership, and about their ability to make change, and about us being able to have something meaningful and worthwhile by coming together. and that you can create a new language if you just think about it. Thanks, Tim.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much, Steve, for coming out tonight.
Sure.
And thank you all for joining us here tonight as well. We have one more event for the year. It will be up in Concord. We will be speaking about coercion in the international sphere. So how do countries use hard and soft power to get what they want? So that will be on December 12th at 6 p.m. up at the New England College Concord campus, which is right on Main Street. So we hope that you can join us there. I also want to announce for the first time our spring series for Global Tipping Points. On February 4th, we will be hosting the Union of Concerned Scientists to talk about nuclear nonproliferation with an eye towards the 2020 elections. On March 4th, we will be hosting Dr. Gonzalez in the back here to speak about her new book that she's coming out with on social movements in Turkey. Some of you may have heard the interview I did with her about the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. So we're really excited for that. And then we also have Catherine Brown, who is the head of the Global Ties US program. She is coming out with a new book, which should be coming out in the next few days, about the media's coverage of the Afghan war and how that is affecting people's viewpoints and understanding of that country. So we're hopeful that you will be able to join us for those. We'll be putting those out online for you soon. So thank you so much again, and we hope to see you in the coming days and next year. Thank you.